Hello, this is Josh Hankin from SandbagFitnessSystems.com, and today I'm joined by a very special guest, Nate Morrison, who I've known for quite some years and is quite an exceptional coach and has been known in the kettlebell community for a while. So I'd like to welcome Nate. Nate, how are you doing today? It's a little crazy over here, as you can tell, but hope things are going well over there.
Oh, things are good, Josh. Thanks for having me on, and just nice to be back in Colorado here where the weather's warming up.
Yeah, I'm a little jealous. It's a little warm already here. And, you know, Nate, I've met you at the different kettlebell programs in the past and never really got a great opportunity to sit down and talk to you. I know a lot of your specialties has to do with military fitness, and I know that has been a really popular subject matter, obviously, with a lot of the conflicts going on. And I also think with the exposure that more and more people want to train to be functionally fit. Can you tell us basically what you've been up to and how you basically developed your system of training?
Sure, absolutely. The whole subject of military fitness is one of those that really I've been struggling with for a long time. We're kind of bombarded with a lot of different stuff, you know, starting years ago with the muscle magazines, and I went through a period of time where I tried pretty much everything I could get my hands on and trying to take the failures that I had out in the field and places where I thought my performance wasn't where it should be. And just went through a process of many, many years of looking at what worked and what didn't and why and that sort of thing. And that involved, you know, the kettlebells were probably the most successful of the tools that we used in trying to get that high level of performance for the military applications. And actually, since the early days of the kettlebells there, I've kind of toned down a little bit of using kettlebells as the primary tool. One of the big evolutions we've had is sort of a big circle where you go from, you know, in the early days just doing the activity all the time in training, and then you kind of branch into trying to use other tools and methods to make yourself better at that, but you kind of abandon what you're supposed to be doing in the first place, and you find that you get into a big circle chasing your tail where you don't ever really improve anything. Maybe you improve your looks or your sprint time or your max bench, but you know that doesn't really carry over very well. And so over the years, we've just kind of come around full circle to, look, just do the primary activity and augment it in a really smart way with the right tools, the right methods, to improve that specific performance. So it's been quite a journey.
It sounds like it. And, you know, I think you've sort of opened up a lot of good questions right in the opening statement. So let's sort of get to the meat and potatoes of it. And before we do, let me sort of just clarify for a lot of people that, you know, you're not one who is a strength coach sitting back, you know, from the outside talking about military fitness. You're obviously heavily involved in, you know, from wherever you can you tell people what you've actually done in the military?
Sure, absolutely. I spent 15 years in an organization in the Air Force called Pararescue. It's one of the two special operations units within the Air Force, at least on the ground combat side, and recently transferred over to the U.S. Army. We won't really get into the organizations I'm with there, but still within the special operations community, and it's absolutely right. I think I'm really probably the only guy out there that's talking about the stuff, that's writing about the stuff, that is actually still doing it and was doing it while I was developing these training programs and these concepts and philosophies. So, you know, I've got about another 15 years left in me. I'll probably retire out at 30 years, but, you know, that means that everything I'm talking about, I'm doing, and so are the guys around me. So,
well, and when you start designing these programs and you talked just prior to about, you know, does it actually improve what you're trying to improve? Well, what do you mean by that? Because some people would sort of look at things and go, well, if I improve my bench or I improve my sprint time, then my training has accomplished its goal. How are your views of training a little different?
Well, it's a really good question. You've got to look at what the realistic goals are. If you're a soldier and you set your goal as improving your max bench press, your goals are, you know, we could say dysfunctional. Because your job is to be the best soldier that you can be. And that means your goals need to revolve around the skills and the tasks that you're going to find within the military setting. So the ability to, haul a very heavy load for a long period of time at a very quick pace, the ability to react explosively in close combat, the ability to relax and to manage fatigue, these sorts of things. And none of those have anything to do with a max bench press or, you know, making your biceps look better. If any of that stuff happens as a side effect of the training that you're doing, there's nothing wrong with that. But to focus on that as the primary is wholly dysfunctional. So the process right now, or the challenge that we have, is getting guys to stop thinking about looking like the cover of Men's Health magazine and, you know, doing the job better, faster, quicker, and where it's not taking as much out of them, and both physically and psychologically on that side.
Sure, and I know in athletics a lot of coaches will say that it's something similar, in football that the combines carry way too much, importance relative to a football player's ability. But, it's sort of like, I know a lot of people are still looking for ways to quantify their training and then to show that, it works. Are there certain means you'd recommend and you'd ideally like to see measured rather than maybe some of the more traditional, like push-up and pull-up type testing protocols?
Oh, absolutely. If you look at something as simple as, say, a 12-mile ruck march, and you just measure your times and engage in training that will improve your speed and performance in the ruck march, there are an alarming number of people that are incapable of hauling a load of, say, 70 or 80 pounds for 12 miles in under 3 hours. That's a pretty big leap for a lot of folks to get down to sub 3 hour. Your better folks are looking at coming in little over 2 hours. So there's a period of, say, 45 minutes. If you can chop 45 minutes off of a 12-mile ruck march in your training, that is massively significant. And it's one of those things that bears some significance, because if you are engaged in workout programs that, say, only tax you for 20 or 30 minutes, you are not conditioned, and people need to understand the real definition of conditioning, but you're not conditioned to an event that will take you somewhere between 2 and 4 hours. You're looking at a very moderate to high intensity activity for that period of time, and your body will adapt. It's that whole SED principle, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't adapt to that level, you're just not going to perform. In fact, you'll find it about 1 hour, you kind of smack into this wall, and you've got to condition yourself past that. So it's very important that people look at those things and understand that's what your goal has to be, and that's how you have to structure your training, and that's where you have to measure your training and performance.
So, on that note, I'm going to sort of ask something kind of controversial, because I know it'll get a lot of people upset. There's a very popular training philosophy, I guess, out there that is especially high towards the military units, and I think you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And their whole thing is, that they're going to get you, as you said, in condition for the demands. What are your thoughts on that type of training, and is that actually the most productive means of training for military fitness?
It's not, and the reason, there's many, many reasons for that. If you want to do the quick, short, 20-minute, super high-intensity type of workouts, I really don't think that anyone ought to do those any more than maybe once a week at the most. I will say that there can be a time and a place for those, but what you tend to run into when you're doing those workouts, even if it's only 3 times a week, you really start to run the body down. The body is not designed to handle that intensity so consistently. And when that becomes your consistent workload there, you tend to run into a lot of the neurological fatigue builds up. There's a lot of psychological fatigue that goes with that, because really it's sort of the same thing. The psychological being what's going on in your brain, your thought processes, is intimately related to what's going on in all of the rest of the neural tissue throughout the body. And you basically burn the candle at both ends on that. And I've talked to so many people that experience that. Metabolically, it doesn't condition you. And a lot of people have found that out. A lot of endurance athletes that are at the top of their game have gone to that methodology for a period of time. And what they find is that they started those workout programs in the top 5 or the top 10 in their field. After a period of months, even a year in those types of programs, when they come back into the sport, they're at the very bottom, you know. And that right there tells us that it doesn't work. You know, if you're coming in dead last or real close to it, or certainly nowhere near the top 10, well, then obviously there's a problem there. Militarily, there are a lot of folks that say, well, the military is sort of the jack of all trades, and so this is good because we never focus on one thing. It's all, you know, they think that they're adapting to many things all at once, and that's just not true. You can only adapt to so much for a certain period of time, and if you never focus on one thing, you can never improve in it. So you can expose yourself to it, but you never get any better. So it's better to do short cycles, four weeks at the shortest. I like to recommend about 8 weeks. Pick a few things, work on those, progress in them, actually get better at those skill sets, then pick something else for another 8 weeks, get better at those. And in that way, you get better at those skills. But otherwise, you're just kind of chasing your tail and feeling good about yourself. So, you're not actually improving your performance for military duties.
Yes, and you know, if you look at all the sports science training, I mean, it's never been shown that you can train all the qualities at once and get a productive training result. So I always found it kind of interesting that people are now trying to accomplish that.
Right.
But you hit on something that's kind of interesting to me, because I have always said to people when I've interviewed them that historically, you know, if you're in the trenches and working with people and you're trying to do good things, you sort of often come to the same conclusions in a lot of ways, sometimes by different means. And I sort of found the same way, you know, I know endurance training and, you know, lower intensity training has sort of gotten a bad rap in the last few years. Everyone's afraid they're going to shrink and lose all their muscle mass and they're going to get weaker. But I also found on the flip side, if you did constantly only high intensity work, that it did cause that exact burnout you're talking about. The fatigue both emotionally or mentally and physically. And so it's kind of interesting that you found the same thing, and especially, you know, that could be relatable to fitness and military, because, you know, sort of both groups can be somewhat similar in the fact that even our general fitness population now is deprived of sleep, poorly nourished. Same thing that you guys, you know, ours may be by choice, but, do you find that the same, that's even a bigger concern when your lifestyle is compromised in the state, like if you are on a mission and so forth like that?
It's actually a very drastic problem in the military. There's people are just addicted to caffeine like you wouldn't believe, and it really does a number on the adrenals, and you know, it really jacks up sleep cycles. And you have so many people that say, oh, caffeine doesn't bother me, I drink a double espresso before bed every night. And talk to any sleep researcher and they say, well, technically he may be asleep as in his eyes are closed, but when you look at what his brain waves and biorhythms are doing, this guy's not resting. And, you know, people get into a cycle there where they're chasing stimulant after stimulant. And I've done this myself, and I'm still weaning myself off of that, where you get into a situation where, especially I knew a lady that was an air traffic controller, and they would keep changing. About every week, they would change the schedule. You're looking at 3 shifts that you could work, and they would change it around almost weekly. And so none of the air traffic controllers, you know, the people controlling planes, making sure they don't crash and run into each other, these people are always in a state of sleep deprivation or trying to adjust to a sleep cycle where, you know, really they stack up against people that are legally drunk. And you get the same thing in with doctors. You know, most of them are so sleep deprived and chasing stimulants, they perform worse than drunks. And this is the guy operating on you. And we face the same problem in the military, except that this guy's supposed to be on watch, you know, not falling asleep on watch, you know, or making critical life-saving or life-taking decisions in split seconds. And when he's having a hard time even staying awake or focusing on things because of that lifestyle, there's a really big problem. So, and this is, none of this is unknown to us. And there's a really big, if you talk to any of the elite coaches, there's, or if you go through any of the sports science or coaching programs, there are entire semesters spent on sports psychology. And we kind of don't deal with that down in the valley of general fitness out there. It's a big unknown to us. So it is. It's very important and very significant.
And you know, so if you're not recommending, okay, burn yourself out, go ball to the wall, excuse the term, mm-hmm. you know, every single workout, how do you sort of, what are you going to do in those in-between workouts, or as I like to call them, feeder workouts? So what's your view on those?
Well, the beauty is the answers have been around for, you know, close to 100 years. There's this thing called periodization. And, you know, some folks have talked about a wave-like structure to working out. But really, if you just think of it as push yourself a little bit and then back off. And if you think about the intensity of your workouts, if you take it one day, you really hard, and then you drop it back to what you could call an easy level, and then bump it up to a moderate level, then push it hard again. If you just push hard and back off, you know, generally, every workout shouldn't smoke you. Muscle soreness isn't the goal of the training. Push yourself, challenge yourself, back it off for a couple of days. Push again hard, back off for a couple of days, and just keep going like that, and you'll be fine. And if you want to get scientific about playing with the volume and doing a little bit of math, all that can be really, really effective. Or you can just gauge it by, you know, your perceived exertion during the workouts. You know, it can be that simple. But people need to understand that you're still gaining, and you're actually going to gain more, and you're going to make better gains if you do that instead of pushing yourself hard all the time. You know, give your body time to recover is really what it boils down to.
Well, I think there's two concepts that are completely overlooked by the majority nowadays. There are old concepts, like you just mentioned. You know, two that I espoused a lot in the sandbag training that we do is one is the rate of perceived exertion, because, you know, and we get a lot of questions. You know, should I try to move up my sandbag by 5 pounds? You know, and then people try to equate it to what they're familiar with instead of just using a very simple system that's been around forever of just basically it's how heavy does it feel, how light does it feel. And, you know, I know Mel Stiff used to talk about cybernetic periodization, basically the similar idea what you were just talking about of, you know, if it's, you know, feeling good and you can push yourself, great. If not, then you need to back off. And, something I like that he did, and maybe is very applicable to what you're doing, especially when there's so much technical work involved, is sort of the rating of technique. Do you use that sort of, system a lot? Basically just, you know, I'm sure it goes along with your firearms and other material, but can it go with fitness as well?
Oh, absolutely, and it has to, and that's one of the areas that is so critically overlooked, and people don't understand just how important technique and skill is, and it's one of the things that I love about Steve Cotter's overall philosophy is that everything is about skill. To him, he doesn't care as long as you're building a high level of skill, and that's critical because there's no such thing as doing one thing in training and another thing when it really counts. You can't do it. Your body is incapable of making that differentiation. So if you are in the habit in training, and this is a problem that I have with most of the general fitness population out there, they have no respect for the accuracy or the quality of the skill or the technique that they're using. If you always pay attention, I don't care if you're doing bicep curls, pay attention to the quality and the skill that you're exercising in that bicep curl or lifting that sandbag and that sort of thing. if you do that, you start to pay attention to how well you shoot. You start to pay attention to what your posture is like while you're doing a ruck march, or your technique while you're climbing a cliff face, you know, those sorts of things. It's sort of funny. I was watching some folks trying to do what a lot of folks are call a muscle up, which is really pretty much the same thing as a mantle shelf in climbing. And they're doing these kipping pull-ups, which meant that they would kick themselves over so that their bodies were darn near horizontal. And when their chest got to the bar, they couldn't figure out how to get up over the bar. And they didn't understand, they couldn't figure out that your body has to be vertical when you meet the bar to rotate your shoulder and arm up over the bar. And they could never figure out that that was where they were being held up, you know. So bad pull-up technique led to the inability to perform a technique that you would need to do if you were, say, trying to get over a wall in downtown Baghdad. So these things come into play, but, you know, no one ever really pays attention. Like I always say, the devil's in the details. Got to pay attention to the details first.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, I think a lot of people get stuck in that mindset that they, hey, I was just talking to a client about this the other day, that they, people assume that exercise is mindless, that people are doing their jobs all day. And then you may find it in the military, if you're on duty all day or on a mission and you try to start training, you know, people don't want to feel like they have to think again. I hate to say that, but like right. You said, if you're going to do the activity, that's a must, because everything has a transferability. I think it was Charles Staley who said it best, everything has a cost, not everything has a benefit.
Right.
So I think it's very apt. And along those lines, you know, I was really surprised, you know, when you and I first spoke, that you had sort of mentioned that you've gotten away from something that I think has become a staple in a lot of military, at least in the mainstream perception of military fitness, which is kettlebell training. So how has your sort of philosophy of kettlebell training sort of transformed over the years?
Well, it's changed from thinking of the kettlebell as a primary tool for military fitness to just another tool. And I love what you've done with the sandbag thing. I think I've mentioned to you before, folks that are, especially in the Marines and a lot of us that are in the special operations community, inevitably you just kind of find something, and sandbags are something that we always have laying around. And, you know, inevitably you or your instructors will torture you with a sandbag, making you do all kinds of things. And so a sandbag is a great tool, you know. The kettlebell is a great tool. And the one thing that I'll say is that the kettlebell, you know, if you've got to deploy overseas, as far as additional fitness equipment that you might bring with you, I still believe that if you just take a couple of kettlebells and a pull-up bar, or you make a pull-up bar there, that's all you need. But the thing that I'll say is that shouldn't be what you do primarily. You should get out there and, you know, run obstacle courses of various varieties. You should be doing a lot of shooting. You should be carrying people and items. You should be ruck marching. You should be doing all of those things, and augment those things with the appropriate kettlebell training or sandbag training or that sort of thing. Because I guess the big difference, to directly answer your question, is kettlebell training can never replace doing the actual activity. So do the actual activity, and then when you look at it from that perspective, you don't need to do, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 different exercises. You just need to build a couple of complexes that are only maybe 2 to 4 exercises in length at the most, and just do those to augment your specific weak areas, to address those particular areas that you need to improve on. And that's part of physical training that is well known at the elite coaching levels. If you go and you talk to a professional football coach, hockey coach, basketball coach, they target their athletes' weak points with special physical training. And that's the way that a soldier's got to do it as well, or at least his physical training leaders or his NCOs. The general fitness population is very, very different from that, because usually you're sitting in an office, you're fairly sedentary, and so you're just chasing activity in general. and that's sort of the general activity, the general fitness market. And that's completely different. And I would say that that's probably really the only way that soldiers and athletes are the same, is the way that they target their weak areas, or they need to target those weak areas in performance. Emmitt Smith wasn't a great running back because he did a lot of bench pressing. He did a lot of, football, and he augmented that with specific strength training. So that's the big difference.
if I were to summarize it, tell me if I'm correct, because I think it's profound yet very obvious at the same time, and a lot of people almost are scared to say it, is that, like most training, and, there's only a very small portion of the training that's actually, and I'll use the term across the board, sports specific, that most training is general.
Yeah.
Right? And kind of fall into that category, as I have always said, sandbags do as well, except for maybe certain sports like wrestling. Otherwise it's very general based training, and I think it's been promoted as it's going to have transferability to everything, even though it's general.
Right.
And I think, from what you're saying, you found that not to be the case, because there's been some, material out there on the internet saying that basically if you do kettlebell work, it's going to be better than anything you could do almost specifically, right? I think you know what I'm speaking about.
Right. Well, and I'm guilty of writing some of those articles, years ago, because it was, honestly so much better than, say, the bodybuilding protocols or the, bodybuild and do powerlifting until you get slow, and then do calisthenics and run until you're weak, and then keep going. Kettlebells were the thing that bridged those two very well, but it still has those limitations that you still have to do that specific activity first and augment it with this. You can't, and that was one of the same failures, was, bodybuilding, calisthenics, powerlifting, running, whatever. It still wasn't the specific activity, and that was the major shortcoming of the training program, not necessarily that we were using barbells versus kettlebells. And you're absolutely right. I mean, it's, again, it's a very general thing. When you get into specifics, you have to be very, very careful. I discovered myself that tampering with volume, and I actually had a conversation with a guy that was a coach for one of the major National Hockey League teams, and he ran into the same thing. Prescribing exercise, looking at your volume, he had a player where all he had to do was drop, he actually retarded his player's performance by giving him too much volume. He was having him do sets of 18 to 24 repetitions. The player's performance sagged, and so they took a few days off, let him recover, changed it, brought the repetitions down to about 12, and the player's performance skyrocketed. So just moving the repetitions around a little bit, tampering with the volume of training, can either really hamper performance or really enhance it. And if you don't have the knowledge and the skill and the wherewithal to look at the problem and diagnose it and change what you're doing by little bits and pieces, you have no business writing or advising people that a particular tool is the second coming of the Messiah when you don't have that level of knowledge, So it's an area that gets really tricky at those higher levels of performance, and I actually just wrote an article about that, where if you think, my big thing these days is mountaineering. If you think of the guys that climb Everest or McKinley, that's sort of the highest level of mountaineering skill, and there are things that you have to do that are radically different to get above, say 14,000, 15,000 feet, and be successful. But the folks that just do a lot of, general hiking and backpacking, running around, they're kind of the folks down in the valley in the general fitness area. You can get away with a lot of stuff, but you're never going to play pro ball, using that stuff. So,
but I think you hit the nail on the head that I think there's some confusion that very deconditioned people, when they start doing even sometimes just bodybuilding activities, but they start doing, more physical activities, their performance and obviously physical activity tests are going to improve. The higher level you get up, the more you have to be careful about things like volume and intensity and the exercise selection, because you almost have more chance to ruin someone, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. And that's something that if you don't, you know, context is such an important thing. You hear a lot of people will get into a new workout program, especially the modality we kind of danced around earlier. And the thing that I always hear is, I'm in the best shape of my life. Well, for you, that may be the case. For Magic Johnson, you're not even close, you know. And so it's all about context compared to what. And, you know, therein lies a lot of confusion as well. People say, I need to be in better shape. I need to be more fit. But fit is in the context of the task to be performed. And so you've got to really examine your goals and look at it. But absolutely, if you're swimming in the guppy pond, you know, it's a whole different deal than when you're swimming with the sharks.
Well, and I think that's a great point because, you know, I think people mistake. I always say to people because they'll ask me, they'll go, have you tried this program or this exercise? And they'll say, it's really hard, as though that qualifies it being good and necessary. And you know, obviously, you know, like you and I spoke about, it's kind of in the context. If I'm competing in a strongman contest, yeah, 10K is going to be hard for me, but it's not going to help my performance for what I'm training for, and vice versa. If I'm, you know, need to have great strength endurance, you know, spending lots of time doing maximal loads isn't going to necessarily help me either, right?
Right, exactly. You hit it right on the head.
But it's not to say that you couldn't, and you brought up earlier, you couldn't cycle that into
sure.
a training system. It's about when you use these tools and methods, right?
Right, right, absolutely. If you look at the various different models of periodization, there's a real a successful coach out there named Tudor Bompa, and his style of periodization uses cycles where you build a particular set of traits. You know, he'll go through a anatomical adaptation phase, and then he'll convert to a phase of maximal strength, and then he'll move into specific skills and working on the tactics and sports skills that are needed, and then you enter the competition phase, and you know you compete, and then you go into kind of a backing off, detraining phase where you know you're basically spending several weeks pulling out, you know, letting your body rest, and then you go back into it again for the next season, and you just keep building, and then every season your performance is getting better and better. You know, this is how people work up from, you know, Joe Schmo on the street into elite athlete status over a period of, say, 10 years, you know. And that works in the professional athletics world where you've got that set schedule. You know years in advance what the date of every game that you're going to play, every Olympic competition. And that's why the Soviets were so successful with it. They had 4 years to take a guy, and so they built their periodization cycles based on a 4-year Olympic cycle so that their guys were peaking at that at the Olympics. You know, that was the best they were going to do in 4 years, you know, and then they would start all over again based on the numbers they achieved there. You and I probably don't have that option, nor that incentive, you know, and especially not in the military. But you can cycle that. There's nothing wrong with it if you know that you're not going to deploy for another year. Nothing wrong with using similar ideas in your periodization, or especially for the general fitness population. You know, your clients could periodize very well. You say, look, here's the goal for the next 8 weeks, and you draw it out. Okay, at the end of 8 weeks, this is where we want you to be. And so here's the plan. Here's the program. You're going to do this for 8 weeks. This is where you're at right now. This is where we think we can get you. Here's how we're going to do it every single day, every single week, all the way up to that. You go through the training program. You evaluate again. You test out on the same exercises at the end of 8 weeks. You look at the improvement that you've made, and then you build a new 8-week cycle. And you just keep doing that. And that's how you make progress, and that's what no one wants you to know out there. But as a strength coach, you know, or general fitness coach, I mean, that's how you're going to give people the real results over a period of time. You don't necessarily have to tell them that, you know, that's what you're doing in the background, but that's how you're going to be a successful fitness coach.
And I think those are principles. I mean, basically, you just outline a great way of just doing goal setting. And I think, you know, something I want to touch on is, you know, you mentioned earlier how people mention a word like conditioning or get in shape. And I can't, those terms drive me nuts because there's nothing more vague than using those terms. You know, when you start, you know, writing programs for people or even yourself, you know, how do you sit down and sort of start to determine what qualities they need to develop most and, you know, where they're strong at and where they're weak at?
I just look at what it is that they want. If someone comes to me and they say, I want to look like the guy on the cover of Men's Health magazine, well, you know, it's kind of hard to beat straight-up bodybuilding for that, you know. And so you say, all right, well, you build a bodybuilding program for that guy. But if someone comes to you and he says, well, I want to be a really great mountaineer and look like the guy on the front cover of Men's Health, you go, well, you're going to have to pick one, you know, because you can't do that. You know, they're opposite ends of the spectrum, you know. So figure out what it is that you really want most, and you can go for that. There are some places where you'll find that there's a little bit of compromise just because you will have certain side effects of training, if you will. If you look at any of the middleweight Olympic lifters, those guys look like they probably do a lot of bodybuilding, but they don't, you know. However, the secret there is that they're not doing anything but Olympic lifting. They've got a coach, they're dedicated to that, and that's what they do day in and day out for years. And it takes years to learn how to do that properly in the first place. But it really revolves around what are your goals. Do you want to be a rugby player? Do you want to be a soldier? Do you want to just look good? You know, those sorts of things. And then, you know, as a coach, you know, someone who's at the higher levels like yourself, you can inject, well, would you also like this or would you like that? And it becomes sort of a responsibility on you as well as the coach or the trainer to make sure that you're keeping that person healthy in that program. If someone says, hey, I just want to have, you know, great pecs and great biceps, you have a responsibility as a coach on the other end of that to make sure that they're developing the back, you know, the posterior deltoids, the low back, that sort of thing, so that you're not causing further harm to this person, you know. Making sure that their development is safe and unilateral. So I always make sure that I look at all of those sorts of things. But it's, you have to do it based on the goals and the performance requirements of the person, because you cannot say this bodybuilding protocol, this random variety protocol, this Bulgarian volume protocol, whatever, applies to all of your goals. You've got to know where to use what tools based on those requirements. So it's kind of how I approach it.
And then with that, you know, I think a lot of people get confused on what they should be doing. You know, having had the experience you've had, having talked to the people you've had, you know, have you seen sort of commonalities between, you know, the general fitness and military fitness as far as principles and guidelines that would be applicable to both?
There are the principles of training that are applicable across the board. Laws of training such as, you know, developing joint flexibility, tendon and ligament strength, those sorts of things. Developing the prime movers before you develop the stabilizing and accessory and neutralizing muscles. You know, meaning that you're building the back and the legs, and maybe even the chest to a certain degree long before you focus on biceps and forearms, kind of thing. All of the principles of periodization, variety, overload, progressive resistance, all those sorts of things apply universally to anyone that's in the business or has the goals of improving their physical performance or their physique, those sorts of things. So those are all the same. The difference is just how you plug them in and how you approach those things will depend very much on who the person is, what their lifestyle is, what their job is, what their requirements are, those sorts of things. If I take a soccer mom who does nothing but a little bit of housework and running the roads with her kids, you know, that program's going to be very different and probably look a lot more like what most people are familiar with bodybuilding protocols, than someone who is supposed to be jumping out of airplanes, hauling loads for a long distance. That person is doing, they need to do what they're doing, which is essentially various forms of manual labor is the majority of what they're doing. Look at their performance, tweak it with exercise. Soccer mom over here, you're just looking at giving her the appropriate activity to burn fat, to keep her in a good muscle balance, give her a little bit of muscle, and I don't want to use the word tone, but that's the popular term. You know, so you help her achieve her goals, but they are both going to use the same principles of training that you can find in something like periodization by Tudor Bompa or super training by Mel Siff or any of the standard textbooks for any of your personal training certifications through either NSCA, ISSA, ASCM, those sorts of things. That sports science is universal.
And when, you know, when you said that, I instantly thought of the fact that, you know, I've worked with some SWAT teams and some military guys, and it seems if when you talk to the higher up, you know, officers and so forth, that there's a big complaint right now that a lot of the recruits are coming in horrific shape. I mean, I know SWAT team leaders that were telling me that, you know, they got people in the academy that couldn't do a push-up.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And they said it's bad. You know, are you seeing that type of trend? And I mean, is it just a sort of a change in our general mindset as a society, or is it sort of still where, you know, in the area you're at, you're seeing a little higher level of fitness coming in?
We tend to see a little bit higher level of fitness just because, you know, the military is something that, you know, you have to go to basic training, and basic training, you have to be able to perform at a certain level to graduate basic training. If you don't, they kick you into a remedial physical training platoon and work with you until you can get to that point, or you're hopeless and they kick you out. But I will say, over my 15 years, I've seen a very fairly dramatic change in the quality of the guys coming into the military. More and more and more. And it just seems to get worse. You know, they called my generation the Nintendo generation. But I guess this would be the PlayStation or the Xbox 360 generation. And kids are coming into the military these days in just progressively worse and worse shape. And the problem that we face with this, and I'd like to spend just a second talking about this, is that you have to understand where a recruit is coming from, and this is important for a strength coach as well, or a general fitness coach, personal trainer, etc. Because, for example, I grew up farming and logging. So my entire life I've been exposed to, you know, at least 12 hours a day of heavy manual labor. So that means that when I came in, I had very high bone density, very high tendon strength, very high ligament strength. My muscles were used to working all day long. My metabolic conditioning was such that I'm used to working all day long, et cetera, et cetera. Those are not adaptations that you can, you know, to a person over a period of 8 weeks or 13 weeks in the Marine Corps, I think 6 weeks in the Air Force still in basic training. You can't do that. And so if you get someone who comes to you and all they've ever really done is light activity, played a lot of video games, never been athletic, or they were athletic but years ago, you cannot take that person from zero to hero even inside of 6 months to a year. You know, this is a process of several years of training that will get that bone density up, that will get the tendon strength, the ligament strength and diameter up. All those sorts of adaptations take a very long period of time. And it's actually one of the things that I plugged in my book was having programs that, you know, say make basic training longer, that make a structured physical training program that looks at and understands that and says, this is how we're going to structure the first several years of this guy's physical training in the military and bring him up to that level. Because you cannot change your base element. You can't go out to the United States and say, everyone must work out more or you can't join the military. You're not going to get anyone in the military or the police. So you have to realistically address the problem and program that training to get those effects in. And you know, police, fire, EMS, military, anyone that's hiring people off the street to do something physical is facing the same problem. And unfortunately, it's going to take some hard changes on the inside of those organizations because we can't change society per se.
Well, I guess that's the danger inherently of being married to an implement or a singular training system, right? I mean, if you take that training system and apply it universally across sport, even if you can theoretically scale it down,
right?
You know, some of the situations that you may have come across, I mean, they're going to need to have, you know, someone who can, you know, take their toolbox and go, this is going to be the right tool for you. This one isn't right now, right?
Right. Oh, absolutely. That's absolutely critical. And the ability to see that in a person, to understand that. And it's interesting. I actually have all of the Army physical training manuals from the early 1900s to present day. And in the 1914 version, they were very, very specific about the importance of NCOs and officers evaluating things like posture and movement and looking for muscle imbalance and dysfunction and applying the right corrective exercise to that because they understood the importance of it. And it's something that we've lost as a whole. The fitness industry is in a pretty sad state right now because I don't ever actually have to set foot in a gym to become a certified trainer in any of these certifying bodies. All I have to do is read a book that I order on the internet, then I get online, I take an online test, and I send in a copy of my CPR certificate, and then I can go down to Bally's and get a job working in there as a personal trainer. I've never even seen a bench, you know, but I'm a certified personal trainer. You know, this person can't help you, you know?
No, absolutely.
and that's interesting.
Those are the people that, you know, unfortunately, people that don't know any better come in and they assume when you're certified that's what you're going to get. And I think, too, the industry is also very guilty of being an industry of extremes. You know, as we were talking about earlier, you know, all lower-intensity moderate work is bad. It's only high-intensity bursts of activity. You know, it's, you know, kettlebells are the only thing you should use, or I hate them completely. And there seems to be no moderation in general. And that's always a challenge with a lot of people because, you know, I think, you know, people want a definitive answer. They want to be able to see it black and white. But I guess that's the challenge where, you know, you bridge science and art together. So before we get too far off topic, I want you to take the opportunity, because you published a new book to talk about it, and then to talk about specifically what's in the book and, you know, maybe how it's different from other material you've had in the past.
Sure. The book is called Military Fitness, A Manual of Special Physical Training. And I wrote the book because my good friend Ian Edgar called me, and if you ever meet this guy, it's very uncharacteristic of him to yell. But he left Barnes & Noble, I think it was, one night, and after looking at all of the fitness books, called me enraged because they're all the same. They're all trying to sell the same thing, and you have a whole host of books out there now targeting the military that are nothing but just do a lot of push-ups and, you know, maybe some bodybuilding and, hey, it's important to run too, don't forget that. And, you know, it's all the same garbage over and over. I see things like, you know, the new rules of lifting, but it's just the title. It's all the same stuff if you look in that book. And he got really mad and said, look, you've been threatening to write a book forever, so do it. And he called me every day for 2 months until I finished the darn thing. But what I did was
I... 2 months is not bad, by the way.
What's that?
I said 2 months is not bad, by the way.
No, well, I got lucky. You know, in reality, I had over the years written 6 or 7 books that I never finished. And all I had to really do was take all that information and string it together into this book. You know, so it was really, Carl Lenore asked me, how long did it take you to write this? And I said, well, I guess realistically about 8 years. So the process of cobbling it all together was about 2 months. But when I looked at it and looked at what I wanted to accomplish in it, I needed people to understand, first of all, what the difference was with, you know, the military versus general fitness or even professional athletes. I also needed them to understand how to go about creating their own programs and understanding how a program is built, because one of the things that I always say is that any volunteer organization is a direct reflection of the society from which it stems from. And in society, what we've gotten to is this mindlessness that you referred to. People like to go to websites where they can just look at, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do today. And that's the level of thought that they put into it. I needed people to understand, why do I cycle? Why do I put things together this way? Why is periodization important? And how to incorporate all those things? So another thing that I told Carl Lenore was, don't let the name military fitness fool you. You'll learn if you read the book, you'll learn that, you know, what those differences are. But if you look at the planning, if you look at the principles, if you look at all of that stuff, it's universal, like we said before. So really anyone can read this and get a lot out of it. And quite frankly, unless you want to go down the route of reading, you know, the very long textbooks by Tudor Bompa or Mel Siff, this is the only book that I know of that actually spells out how to plan for the next 8 weeks to 2 years, or even 4 years, if you will. And it breaks it down. It's really easy. We've got checklists in there, and if all you do is just follow that, you know, you can build your own programs. It's really quite easy. But I think it'll probably upset a lot of people, because there's a lot of money to be made in creating dependence on you. You know, if I always have to go to Nate Morrison or Josh Henkin for what I'm going to do next, I mean, you know, where does that end? You know, I want to enable people, teach people how to fish, and they can feed themselves forever, you know. So
I'm not going to be able to retire the way you're talking.
But, you know, it's interesting.
I'm just kidding.
Well, and in a very real sense, because, you know, what I find is that when it comes to things like customer loyalty and all that sort of thing, I think that people really appreciate someone that levels with them, you know. And in the short run, you know, maybe it's easier to get, you know, 15 soccer moms to rely on you all the time. But I think I'm a big believer in karma, and I'm a big believer in spreading the wealth and the knowledge and that coming back to you. And, you know, I think that the more guys like you and I share those sorts of things, I mean, you when you empower people, you develop, you know, a loyalty to you and your organization and everything that you're doing. And I think that in the long run, especially for long-term business and that sort of thing, I think that's a lot better and a lot healthier, because what you tend to see if you look around, there will be these very bright sparks, the one-hit wonders, you know. They come in, boom, make a big impact. Seems like everyone's doing it, and then it's gone because it's unsustainable. You know, people figure it out eventually. They say, well, that was cool for about 6 months, and then I didn't get anything out of it, and so I left, you know. I think you've got longevity if you enable people. So it all comes around in the end.
I agree, and joking with you, you know, it's the principle, you know, like you said, and when you empower people, I mean, you and I could sort of just get a group of people that just sort of spit back what we said and not have an understanding, but then if you don't understand the principles and basically the knowledge to apply these things, then those are the same people that are going to jump from one thing to another because someone else is going to rationalize something to them that sounds you know, that sounds good. And if you truly understand, then you can become a critical individual. And critical doesn't mean cynical. You can just start judging what is useful information and what's not, and you can obviously gain a lot more out of your training. And hopefully, you know, I think you and I have the same goal of becoming resources for people and not gurus and worship. You know, we'd much rather be a resource and you know, give good information and have good ideas. But also, you know, I think people forget that people like yourself and I are always learning. And you mentioned earlier that your philosophy has changed over the years. Obviously, mine has as well, and it's probably going to evolve 10 years from now. And I think some people forget that. You know, if they see us say something different later on, it's because, well, we found out something different works better.
Right.
But going back to the book, you know, I think it's a really great book because, too, you mentioned Tudor Bomp on Mel Siff, and there's a group of guys that did a great job of teaching principles, but sometimes it's hard to bridge the gap between, okay, here's the science, now what do you actually do?
Right.
It sounds like your book sort of accomplishes that goal, right?
It tries its darndest, that's for sure. and you know, where I think it does a very good job of that is if you look at the principles and you always refer back to the principles, I think within my little planning checklist, I think somewhere in there it mentions, you know, making sure that what you've just built follows the principles and the rules of training. So if you were to, you know, design a program where you're going for your max bench press on exercise one and exercise six is, endurance rowing, there's a problem there. You're violating the rules. You're going against the principles of training, and you may adapt to a certain point, but you're not going to achieve, you know, the maximum performance that you could. And so if you refer, you know, and it's as simple as just flipping from one chapter to the next. You know, you flip back and you read through the principles of training and go, you know, I don't think that's going to work. You know, maybe I need to put that onto a different day, a different week, a different cycle, you know, to accomplish that particular thing. You know, so I think it's like you said before, I think it's going to be a very good resource for people.
And, you know, I think nowadays it just seems like, I don't know if it's just I just keep having to run into people, but that people have someone in their family that's in the military now, obviously with a lot of conflict and other situations in the world coming about. So this seems like a book that's, you know, hitting right at the right time because there does seem to be a ton of confusion for people. And so if people want to, you know, pick up the book for themselves or a family member or a friend, where can they get the book at?
They can go to www.alpinetactical.com, and that's my personal website. Right now it's the only place that it's available, but we've got a couple of other folks in the pipe that are probably going to start selling it soon.
Excellent. And you mentioned too, I mean, it's a principle-based book. I mean, I'm sure there's lots of programs in there that, you know, you can modify for even the general fitness person, but it sounds like the principles you're talking are very applicable even to people just want to get a good fitness program. Is that correct?
Right. Yep.
Yeah. So, I mean, I really want to encourage people because I've seen the book. It's a lot of great material. And, you know, instead of, you know, just simply plotting out cookie cutter programs, Nate does a really exceptional job about being very minded of principles, programs, and giving sort of an all-encompassing book. So I really highly recommend that people go visit alpinetactical.com to pick it up. And the name of the book is, if I'm correct, is Military Fitness, a Manual of Special Physical Training?
That's correct. Yep.
Awesome, Nate. And I really appreciate your time. This has been really a lot of fun for me. I enjoyed getting a chance to talk to you and learn more about your philosophy, and I hope we'll be able to do it again soon.
Yeah, thanks, Josh. It was great being here.
Absolutely. And make sure, again, one more time, Nate's website is alpinetactical.com. And this is Josh Henkin for SandbagFitnessSystems.com.